Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And for the second and third segments of the program today, Alfred Adask will be talking with James Corbett of the Corbett Report, as he does most Thursdays, and I will be joined with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs right after the market report. So let's get started right away for April 16th, 2015. And gold today was down $3, currently at $11.99. Big swings today from the low of $11.93 to a high of $12.09. Silver's up, down six at $16.35. Platinum is down one at $11.64, along with palladium up nine at $782. The USDX today is trading lower, although that's coming off its lows of the day, down 77 at 97.56. Crude oil up 13 cents at 56.52. And the markets today, they couldn't stay positive. They tried. The Dow was down just 7 points, 18,105. The NASDAQ down 3, 5,007. The S&P basically unchanged, 2104. 10-year yield, 1.88%. I have the yen here, but we usually talk the euro, 108, 1.08 for the euro, up 0.87. So it's interesting to see the hit on the dollar with the euro rising, the rising cost of oil rising, and gold is down. So if these things continue through to tomorrow, I would expect a decent day for gold tomorrow. And should have been way above the 1209 that we saw for the high today, but it's a good time to still be picking up your gold and silver packages. The $650 package, $20 face value of 90% silver. And we also have a quarter ounce American Gold Eagle. It includes your shipping costs, and it includes the book, All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. And we certainly do know that our government, along with the bankers and Wall Street, they have basically destroyed. Wall Street is their bank. Wall Street is how they fund in order to destroy this country. So although it looks like it's positive with stock markets being high, I believe the higher it goes, the more destruction we see in this country. So get the book. You know, it doesn't tell all, but it's an interesting read. I started reading it, and it's an interesting read. And there's a lot of research involved, and she has certainly gone back through all the various presidents and their connections. J.P. Morgan is probably the longest banker to be hanging around out of all of them, but certainly you see the relationships, and it has certainly ruled the world. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Give us a call for your package, $650. We still do have the 2015 package going on. Give us a call, and we can go over that with you. We have Wendy Wilson joining us from Apothecary Herbs. Good afternoon, Wendy. Well, I thought Miss Wendy was there.
I'm sorry, I'm here. I'm sorry, I hit my wrong button. I'm so sorry about that. How are you?
I'm doing just fine, Wendy.
Awesome. Well, I thought we could talk about the physician of no value for just a minute. You ever hear that term?
Physician of no value. I've just heard it.
Well, it's mentioned in the Bible, actually. Mm-hmm. In ancient times, a physician of no value was considered a forger of lies. So if we go back over 2,000 years, we know that by some of the ancient texts that the most common ailments were eye infections, skin diseases, respiratory problems like consumption, malaria, and typhoid fever. So the people of the ancient world kind of, you know, used what was at their disposal. They used foods and herbs and spices. But if there were physicians available, the people understood that although the physician had a duty, the people had this strong conviction that the real power to heal was divine. And often the ancient physicians were considered holy men or wise men because they had some skill with the medicinal plants, but they also possessed a faith in the Creator. But there were some in the ancient kingdoms that practiced a different type of healing art, which was more like a witchcraft or magic. They were using the alchemy to treat sickness, and they were considered by many to be physicians of no value. Even King Solomon was recorded in Deuteronomy 32 to say that herbs, or the modifying of the herb that's applied for a cure, was really the Lord who did the curing because all was in his hand. So you see in the ancient texts and even in the Bible, there's mention of the first physicians even in ancient Egypt. They had different classes of physicians in Egypt. The physician usually was called the snu, S-N-U, and their ability was to heal with magic, with mythical incantations and things like that. And they weren't scientists. They had absolutely no knowledge of human anatomy. It was almost non-existent. So during the times of the Bible, Melody, there weren't any priests that were physicians, and any cure that a prophet was said to have done was recorded as a miracle from God and not a physician's treatment. So, but I like to tap into scripture because it's just got some really interesting insights. It talks about herbs a lot to restore the body, because in the first book of Genesis, God calls herbs meat. Do you know what that means, Mel?
Tell us.
Well, meat means it's got power. Okay, like, you know, meat has a lot of protein. A lot of people don't think of herbs and plants as being very powerful, but they do. And then if you go to Psalms 104, King David says herbs are here for the service of man. So he clearly understood there was some powerful benefit to the medicinal properties of herbs. And it was said his son, King Solomon, had the time and the money to collect a lot of information and some drawings on the medicinal herbs. And it was said that he listed these herbs along with symptoms and prepared an ancient text of cures, and it was called the Cipher Reputha, which means symptom report. Very cool. So it was recorded, they recorded a lot of medicinal uses of herbs, but it was said it was banned from use from the 13th king of Judah, Hezekiah. Man, what a party pooper. But anyway, the book of Ezekiel also mentions that the fruit and the leaves of the trees have medicinal powers. But it really wasn't until the school of Alexandria came about in Egypt that, you know, science kind of crept into medicine at Melody. And do you remember the school of Alexandria? Do you remember your history?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the school was a kind of a museum of intellectual writings from all facets of life. So Alexandria at this time was kind of looked upon as that cosmopolitan city with, you know, it's a mysterious land of hidden knowledge. So the Greeks, the Egyptians, all the Jews alike, they kind of flocked there. And I guess if you had over 700,000 volumes of writings, you'd be considered the place to be in the ancient world. So, but, you know, the science didn't creep into the healing arts until then. And we can also see that in modern times, you know, it's sometimes not all about science either. They've got alchemy going in modern medicine because they put mercury in vaccines, and that supposedly is an alchemy treatment. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, it's interesting how all this information goes back so long ago, and it's just like gold and silver. I mean, for over 5,000 years, gold has been recognized as a currency. Herbs has been recognized as healing properties. So, I mean, these are the true basics of life. I mean, truly, both physically and in our, you know, whatever you want to call it, our financial or of our living needs in order to survive. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, scripture even says that sometimes herbs were used to pay tithes at the temple. Mm-hmm. So it was like a currency. And of course, where we get the term salary is from salt, because in Rome, they paid the Roman soldiers their ration of salt. That was their payment. So if they messed up and didn't do what they were supposed to, that's where you got the term that he wasn't worth his salt. But anyway, they've excavated some ancient rooms in Rome and in parts of Italy, and they have revealed surgical instruments that look pretty similar to what surgeons are still using today. And you are familiar, a lot of people have heard about the Hippocratic Oath that came about to supposedly protect patients from physicians of no value, right?
Yeah.
And now, it was supposed to protect people from, you know, the healing craft of sorcery. It was a pledge that physicians took to do no harm, and it was required, actually, at graduation from European medical schools from 1508 to 1804. But by the 1900s, the oath was considered outdated, and it was only required by 20% of the U.S. medical schools. Now, by 1948, the General Assembly of the World Medical Association adopted to replace the Hippocratic Oath with the Declaration of Geneva. And it's really interesting that that declaration includes statements similar to the HIPAA laws in modern healthcare, if you look at them. It's crazy. So,
very much.
I know. So, now in 1964, Professor Lasagna, don't you like that name? He was at Tufts.
It's just
University.
Been one of those days, so why not?
Okay. Well,
at least it wasn't spaghetti.
Or Mr. Meatball. Okay, so Professor Lasagna at Tufts University Medical School, he amended the Hippocratic Oath to be more sensitive to modern healthcare politics. So he removed the restrictions mentioning surgery, euthanasia, abortion, and having sexual relations with your patients. So even this oath today is merely ceremonial. It has no obligatory, bears no legal weight. So the philosophy now is, you know, the oath was really, medicine says that the oath should never, impact their professional realm. But, you know, the whole thing about the Hippocratic Oath, Melody, was to preserve life. Medicine was never to be lethal, never to cause suicide, never to euthanize, and never to make the womb a grave. Okay, that was one of the things. Or several things that was mentioned. So the oath used to demand this strict loyalty to divine laws of ethics. It was meant to preserve life. That's what it was meant to do. But the oath was, you know, too restricting for modern physicians, and they've opted, they don't want to be bound by that oath, therefore they don't want to take the Hippocratic Oath, and they don't take it anymore. Did you know that?
What was that time frame that you said when they changed it, when they changed the oath?
1964.
And that was Mr. Lasagna?
Yep. So doctors today are agreeing they don't want to be bound by 2,500-year-old philosophy. They say science has changed. They say that drugs that promote suicidal tendencies, euthanasia procedures, abortion, basically, you know, that's the new social contract. So So, but you know, there are some doctors. There are some doctors that say, you know, that should be Dr. Howard Markel. He's the author and professor of the medical history at the University of Michigan. He says today, the need for physicians to make a formal warrant of diligent moral and ethical conduct to serve their patients is even stronger than ever. So he thinks it's more necessary today than ever. I agree.
It really is. I mean, when you look at, when you see our morality, when you see, you know, things changing so quickly with no accountability for hardly anything anymore, it would take almost a self-sacrificing oath in order to, you know, to commit and to take care of patients as they once were. Or committed to, anyway. Or committed to, yeah.
Well, a lot of people are surprised to find out the Hippocratic Oath swore doctors to have to help heal with dietary regimens. So physicians were to have some sort of working knowledge of nutrition. But what was really interesting is I had a conversation recently with someone, and we were talking about antibiotics, and that term means against life. Okay, so everything's kind of switched over for, you know, preserving life to be against life. So although antibiotics have been known to save hundreds of thousands of lives in the 20th and 21st century, we may want to consider at what cost, okay? Because we've got now 2 million people a year in the United States get infected with the drug-resistant bacteria, and 23,000 of them die from it. So there's really, we have to take stock in this. Plus, out of the 150 antibiotics we do have, penicillin is the number one cause for anaphylactic shock and death.
Penicillin?
Okay. Yep, 1 in 5,000 dies from having a penicillin product.
Huh?
Yep. So, and we inject most of the animals now with antibiotics. Our farm animals, which we consume, in the 30-year period, went to from 600% to 1,500%. So, over half of those antibiotics manufactured in the United States go to the animal husbandry industry. But here's an important thing. I know I'm running out of time, but here's an important thing. Dr. Fleming was on the team that helped developed the first antibiotics, okay, at Harvard published a report. This was at Oxford when they were developing the first antibiotics and penicillin. And here's what he says. In an interview at Oxford, he says that the research team under Dr. Fleming acknowledged in 1942 that bacterial strains would become more prevalent with the use of penicillin. And then again in his interview in the New York Times in 1945, he said that there would be an evolution of other resistant organisms as a result of using antibiotics. And there was no drug that fights bacteria that would not produce the same. So they already knew when they created this monster that it would cause mutations and drug resistance, even though medicine over the years has said that we had no way of knowing. They knew when they developed it. So, yeah.
Amazing. It really is. I mean, where's this all headed? And I'm reading articles today, Wendy, of how, you know, they planned in the next 7 or 8 years in order to extend life for 1,000 years. But if you're,
I don't know if I want to live that long. I mean, you know, I kind of looking forward to going home. You know what I'm
you
saying?
You better have a really good retirement plan.
All right. Well, you know, here's the thing. I think what they've done is they may have saved a few lives in this generation and the next, but then the future generations are what I call in chemical shackles. You know, with all these drug resistance, and they're really not making any more antibiotics because it costs them over $800 million from bench to bedside to develop an antibiotic. So that's why the pharmaceuticals have shifted to less expensive types of meds. So I tell people, you probably got a poor man's antibiotic right now in your fridge. It's called garlic and the hottest salsa you can stand. So people better just get used to the notion they're going to have to do it themselves.
Wendy, give us some information, please.
Sure. Sure. We have a website, thepowerherbs.com, but if you don't do internet, you can certainly call toll-free at 866-229-3663, and we'll help you out, give you a free product catalog, 866-229-3663, because with God's good herbs, you're more powerful than you think.
All righty. Thank you for joining me, Wendy. We'll see you next Wednesday. And you'll be back then, and I want to make sure the listeners stay tuned for Alfred Adesk and James Corbin.
Have a heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adesk here on Financial Survival. I'm here with James Corbett, our guest, calling in from Japan, where he's been living and working for the past 11 years. He started the Corbett Report about 8 years ago, as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also editorial writer for the International Forecaster, a weekly e-newsletter created by the recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. Oh, James, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. And you know what? Sometimes I have to remind myself we're on opposite sides of the planet talking right now because it sounds sometimes like we're in the same room.
I understand. It is so astonishing. It really is just something you look at it and you think, my God. And not only are we... I can remember when long-distance telephone calls used to cost a quarter a minute. And now they're
free. When a quarter a minute meant something.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And now they're free. It's pretty astonishing. It's one of the, you know, it's one of the good things that you can see in this life. There are other things that we can look at, and they don't inspire a sense of wonder so much as maybe horror at times. Here's one example from the New York Times. Nuclear reactors in Japan remain closed by judge's order. That's the headline. And they're talking about 13 commercial nuclear reactors along the coastline in Fukui Prefecture. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But they go on, and a judge has recently signed an order that at least local atomic energy facilities are not going back on the grid. And the article says, in part, Fukuya has emerged as a battleground for the Japanese government's effort to rebuild the nuclear industry and reverse the economic impact of the reactor shutdowns. Now, first off, how are you going to rebuild the nuclear industry? It sounds like they've got new ideas. They're going to clean these things up, put a fresh coat of paint on them, and maybe paint some daisies and happy faces on them, and then everything will be okay. Is it possible to rebuild the nuclear energy industry at this time in Japan?
At this time, I would say it is primarily a PR campaign. That's what this ultimately boils down to, because the nuclear industry would be more than happy to go back to business as usual, which we all know how that turned out on March 11th, 2011. But they're more than happy to do that and to continue running their shoddy operations and basically living on the brink of another disaster, as long as it makes them money, which it always obviously does. The only problem is that there's obviously so much resentment towards the nuclear industry here in Japan right now, and there's still, I mean, such a strong movement against the idea of restarting these reactors amongst the general public that they just can't go ahead with it politically at this time, although they've tried. They've definitely tried. And the Shinzo Abe prime minister, who came in a couple of years ago here, has made it one of his planks to restart the nuclear industry. And the Nuclear Regulatory Authority, or Nuclear Regulation Authority, which was created in the wake of Fukushima to be the new regulator for the nuclear industry, since the old one didn't do so well, has actually given its thumbs up to these restarts. It is just the courts now that is holding this back, specifically in Fukui Prefecture, as you noted there. And from what I understand, the judge who has issued this order, Hideaki Higuchi, is known for being, or is becoming known for being, a bit of a renegade on this issue and basically putting his feet down on this issue. So if it wasn't for this judge basically being the roadblock, this would already be happening and the restarts would already be going on. I think a lot of people in the general public are happy about this. And really, at this point, it is a battle for the hearts and minds of the public, because if the public go along with it, then I think the restarts will happen and everything will go back to business as usual.
I see that the article, and it says at one part, none of the 48 usable reactors in Japan are back online. Apparently, there are 48 reactors total. None of them are online at this time. If that's correct, what kind of impact has it had on Japan? Are your energy supplies diminished dramatically where it makes a difference, a noticeable difference, or is the world getting by without nuclear?
Well, this is a really key point of all of this, because if there is one thing that the Fukushima disaster has exposed, I think undeniably, it's that the old lie that Japan just could not maintain its society without nuclear power is a lie. It obviously can do so. Now, it's not to say that this is a comfortable situation for Japan, generally speaking, and we've seen that in the last few years with Japan running up a trade deficit for the first time in years because they're importing so much LNG primarily to keep the power going. But the power is going, and there have been no long-term or noticeable disruptions in power supply, even in the Tokyo area, where obviously TEPCO has been greatly affected by this disaster. Even in the immediate wake of the disaster, in the summer of 2011, they were saying we might have to ration electricity and all of this. But basically, I mean, some businesses changed their operations and went with more natural light and less electric light and things like that. And there was no, at least no disruptions. There was obviously, I mean, it was tighter in terms of the energy supply. So it can be done. It's not economically comfortable, but it can be done. And it really does expose the lie that Japan just couldn't rely on anything other than nuclear.
I had a friend of mine named Terry Lofton. He passed away a couple of years ago. Lofton, he was involved in legal reform, and he collected books. And he'd go to estate sales looking for law books, you know, to just nose around. He was at an estate where he picked up a 3-volume set for the operation manual for the Federal Reserve. Right now, if you wanted to see this, you could go to the Federal Reserve and say, we'd like to see the 3-volume set. My understanding is they'll let you go in there, go into a room and look at it. You've got a half hour. You can't take any notes. You can't take any recording devices. And if you want to come back, they make arrangements. They can probably squeeze you in 6 months from now again. The book is not, this 3-ring set is not easily, you know, found by the average person. Lofton got this, and it was undoubtedly dated from some rich guy's house, and who knows, he was involved in the banking industry, and he had a copy of the manual. It might not have been current. But what was interesting, I never saw the manuals myself, but Lofton had them, and Lofton read them, and he told me there was one section in there where the Federal Reserve said, we will not lend money to unconventional energy. All right, solar, wind, they'll lend money if it's going for petroleum, for coal, and for nuclear. And by establishing that, they were essentially establishing energy policy in the United States. I mean, if there's some varieties of energy that can't get funding, well, then guess what? They're just going nowhere. And you mentioned something about, oh, the way Japan is attempting to, the government is trying to push nuclear. Do they have similar restrictions or inhibitions or on solar, for example, or is that a viable technology where you are? Wind, I would expect, out of work. Is that
solar
something that takes place in Japan?
That's right. Well, solar has definitely been more and more of the equation here, as there have been government programs and incentives for a while now for people to put solar panels up and then to sell some of that power back into the grid. So that's been going on for a while now, and I don't think it generates a large proportion of the overall power here, but at least it is somewhat growing and easy to do, relatively. However, I think some of the more interesting ideas are some of the experiments that are taking place and have been taking place with such things as tidal power, which obviously, if we could manage to harness that, I mean, that would be an incredible resource, especially for an island nation like Japan. So there's obviously a really interesting...
A lot of listeners wouldn't understand what you mean by tidal power.
So basically the idea of spinning turbines by not by boiling water or anything of that sort, but just simply the motion of the tides in and out can actually turn turbines, which can then power generators. So completely natural, completely, once you get it set up and working, it would be completely, well, not free, but basically free to operate. I mean, you just have to maintain the systems. So it would be an incredible way of generating power. And one that they are working on. I know there's been some testing done, I want to say in the North Sea. I might be completely wrong with that, but I know there's been some testing of these types of systems going on. And the last I checked, there was some plans for some experiments to be held off of the coast of Japan with regards to that. So that would be exciting. And there's a lot of untapped geothermal energy in Japan as well. And I can't remember how many megawatts of untapped potential there are, but I remember it being quite a large proportion. It's just that a lot of the geothermal potential right now is kind of tied up as tourist spots for hot springs and things of that nature. But if Japan really wanted to, if
pictures of the monkeys, the snow monkeys, whatever they are, they must have staked out at least a couple of hot pools.
I think they have. Yeah. Exactly right. So you're exactly right. But with regards to that Federal Reserve manual that you talked about, I have a couple of things to say to that. First of all, I think the underlying point of that story is that, yes, I think in a previous generation, 100%, it's quite obvious that the powers that shouldn't be tried and consciously were able to direct money and investments and energy, excuse the pun, into the coal and fossil fuel industry and the nuclear industry in order to build those industries up at the expense of possible alternatives. I think that's quite demonstrable. But the underlying point of that is they can easily flip that on a dime and support, you know, anything else that they want to at the expense of the coal or nuclear industries, which I think we've seen in recent years. We've seen Rockefellers and Rothschilds and others divesting themselves of their historical oil connections and promoting more and more green power, not because they care about the earth, but because it's going to be a more efficient way of bringing in the type of global dictatorship that they want to bring about. Mm-hmm. And people who are interested in that can look into the proceedings of the Fourth World Wilderness Conference that was held in Denver in, I believe, 1988. And some of the audio recordings of those proceedings were taped, including one of the Rothschilds, I believe Edmund de Rothschild, talking about how they needed to create a second Marshall Plan, basically starting a World Conservation Bank to work on debt relief and stable development, of course, but basically just creating another big, giant cash cow pool of billions of dollars for the global elite to play with. So I think, again, the point it really is that they can continue to direct the money wherever they want, and if solar or wind or whatever will be the convenient way for them to do that, they will do so, and I think there are signs that's happening. My second point with regards to that would be, does your friend still have a copy of this? Can it be digitized?
In fact, he sold it to an airline pilot. All right? He sold it for $100.
I would gladly have paid more than that.
I tried to borrow that copy from the airline pilot, and originally he wouldn't let me see it. And then later on he told me he had thrown it in the trash because it wasn't doing him any good, which I regarded as the equivalent of you have a copy of the Gutenberg Bible. Nah, I wasn't reading it, so I threw it in the trash. It was just, to me, it was a blasphemy. You know, why anyone would trash any sort of books, practically. Yeah. You know, I regard that as suspect. I don't care if it's romance novels. You know, probably, maybe you can throw those in the trash, but maybe not. You know, but a book like that. And I don't know that he really did it, but regardless, he shut the door where I couldn't see it. And this goes back, the story goes back to the 1990s. That's when he had this, probably mid-1990s, so it's, you know, 20 years ago at least. And the volume might have been from the 1980s. I don't know what the date was on the original volume, but just the same. Nope, it's not accessible, and it galls me to this day. I'd like to get my hands on that. One of the things about it is this. It's true that they can change on a dime, and they can start funding solar, for example, or wind, or tidal energy, whatever they want. I get that. But you also have to sit back and say, look, if these people had been making their credit available to everybody back in the 1980s and the 1990s and so on, where would our solar energy industry be today? It may be that they can turn around, and they perhaps have turned around the last 10, 15 years. But after 20 years of suppression, we're 20 years behind the curve. We could have been ahead on this thing. We could be much further down the road, except for the manipulation, and it was done in order to maintain profits for, you know, some special interests. So, what do you do? It's just part of life. But it's
that fundamentally is the argument that's made by the people who say that rather than getting rid of the Federal Reserve, we should just nationalize it. We should take it over and use it as a public utility, basically, because that's what credit should be. And I understand, and I'm somewhat sympathetic to that viewpoint, although I don't think the government should have anything whatsoever to do with the money supply, regulating it, creating it, overseeing it. But that's just me anyway. But I understand the point, because credit, ultimately, what credit is basically saying, yes, we will work towards paying off this debt or whatever, but we will do it for a specific purpose. And if we're creating money as some sort of infrastructure projects, or if we're creating it for investing in alternative energy research or something, then we can be doing something actually useful and creative with this rather than just spending it away in a
rather than just profitable
derivative. Exactly. Yeah. But But having said that, I think more so even than potential solar energy research or what have you, I think the real potential out there is for zero point energy or other types of alternative energy research that I have no doubt has been suppressed over the years. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head. I believe they still say that the SR-71 or whatever it was, the Blackbird, is still the fastest plane in the world or whatever, 5 decades old at this point. If you think that they haven't been able to come up with better technology than that in the last half century, I have a moon rock to sell you. So, I mean, it's ridiculous.
You hold on to that moon rock. You hold on to the moon rock, and maybe we'll make a deal after these commercials. We've got to take a break. I'll be back with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Please stay tuned.
Financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at the 3Ws dot thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. My guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. And I've got an article here from 24hgold.com, Ghosts in the Machine. It talks about Thomas Robert Malthus. In 1798, 32-year-old British economist Malthus anonymously published an essay on the principle of population, and he argued that human populations increase geometrically, 1, 2, 4, 16, and so on, while the food supply can only increase arithmetically, 1, 2, 3, 4. Since food is obviously necessary for us to survive, unchecked population growth in any one area or involving the whole planet would lead to individual pockets of humanity starving or even mass worldwide starvation. That was his argument. And he said at one point, the power of population is indefinitely greater than the power of the earth to produce subsistence for man. Again, this is Thomas Robert Malthus. And we are talking back near the time when this country was created, talking 2 centuries ago. Now, Malthus fell out of favor. He was the boogeyman. He says, oh, the whole thing's going up for grabs. And yet then, maybe in the 60s, 70s, no later than the 70s, science began to argue that Malthus was incorrect, that we could keep up with population with genetically modified foods ultimately and whatever else, pesticides and so on. And more recently, he's coming back. People are beginning to say, uh-oh, wait a second. We've kind of exhausted the Green Revolution. And it looks like maybe we are going to start running out of food and water and whatever. So what's your position on Malthus? Is his idea still valid, or is it, you know, can science overcome? And if not, how long before we begin to see real trouble in this world?
Well, thank you for this question. It is such an important question, because I have no doubt that if the listeners out there, or at least around my age, they've probably been subjected to Malthusian propaganda their entire lifetimes and have subconsciously internalized the idea that we are about to run out of the last drop of water and about to run out of the last grain of rice, and we're all on the edge of some sort of giant disaster. But as you point out, Thomas Malthus was writing over 2 centuries ago now, and he was predicting within a generation there would be horrible effects, and we had to start doing things like putting poor people in marshy, boggy areas so that they would become more disease-prone, so they would die off quicker, so that they wouldn't be using up the food of the, you know, good, respectable, rich people like himself. So this is the mentality of Malthus and the Malthusians who have come in his wake for the last 2 centuries, running around like Chicken Littles, saying every single generation, this is the time, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And he has fallen in or out of favor from time to time, but I would say definitely since the 1960s, we've seen a vehement return of the Malthusian propaganda line. Through people like Paul Ehrlich, and people might remember back in 68, I believe he wrote The Population Bomb, the bestseller about how there's going to be food riots in America in the 80s, and by the year 2000, England will not exist, was one of the predictions there. He wrote, before 1985, mankind will enter a genuine age of scarcity in which the accessible supplies of many key minerals will be facing depletion. He was proven wrong on all of those points in spades. In fact, there was actually a famous wager that he made with an economist called Julian Simon, where they bet. The bet was that Ehrlich could choose any mineral, any raw material, and Simon would bet that in 10 years' time, the price would actually come down of that material. And so Ehrlich bought $1,000, or bought, in quotation marks, $1,000 worth of copper, chrome, nickel, and tin and tungsten from Julian Simon in 1990 at 1980 prices. So they wagered over the course of the 1980s. And that $1,000 worth of material in 1980 prices was $576 in 1990 prices. So again, Ehrlich was proven wrong in that prediction as well. Time and time and time and time and time again, these predictions are proven wrong. And yet time and time and time again, we keep getting fed the same thing. It's going, this disaster is right around the corner. It's going to happen. What we have here is the fact, the indisputable fact, that absolutely human population is growing. It will continue to grow, likely until the middle of the century, at which point it will taper off and start actually declining. But until that point, it is growing, but so is the pie. The overall pie that we're baking continues to grow. There is enough food on the planet to feed everyone on the planet with no one starving to death. It is not a question of the actual supplies. It's a question of how they are distributed and basically where people are living and what kind of governments they're under. That type of thing determines the economic conditions they're living in more so than the Earth itself. I mean, is there a theoretical carrying capacity? Could we have 1 trillion people living on the planet happily? Well, of course not. But are we anywhere near that? There is absolutely no sign that we are. I would suggest, if people are interested in this topic, I did a couple of reports on this. One's called Bracing for Demographic Winter. The other is called The Last Word on Overpopulation. I think it's really important to confront this myth because, of course, what underlies this? What is the underlying urge for this? Why is it still promoted so heavily in the corporate and establishment media? It's because it gives the would-be elites their chance to rule over the world and to bring about their not only their one-world government in the name of, oh, won't someone think of the children, we're all going to be overpopulated and die, but also to bring about the depopulation agenda. Prince Philip, of course, said in 1988, in the event I am reborn, I'd like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve overpopulation. And Ted Turner saying that a total world population of 250 million people would be ideal. Those types of, I mean, just unthinkable advocation of slaughter of billions of people, basically, is what that amounts to. And it's all seen as, oh, well, it's for the good of humanity because of this impending crisis. So I think it's a load of baloney scientifically, as well as just in terms of the philosophy behind it. But it's important that we call that baloney out for what it is before it has a chance to do genuine damage to real human lives.
I saw a report a year or two ago, and I can't tell you the source per se, I just remember the content. And their argument was, I never checked the math, but I think I'm going to trust that this is valid. Their argument was that you could take all the people on the face of the earth and house them all in a suburban environment, right? Population comparable to a suburban environment, not urban, suburban, where we're all living in ranch houses and rest of that sort of thing. We all had our half acre or whatever. But you could put them all in a state the size of Texas, one giant megapolis, giant city the size of Texas, and you leave all the rest of the world uninhabited. Now, it seems to me if you've got that much uninhabited space in this world, you've got an opportunity for growing an awful lot of corn and wheat and whatever. And it indicates it's consistent with what you're saying here. The world is not overpopulated to the extent many of us suppose. We get that impression, I think, from living in an urban environment. We live in the big city, and there's people all over, and you begin to think, boy, this place is overpopulated. But in fact, there's a lot of wide open space in this world, and more than enough, probably, to grow crops for some time into the future. So it appears that you are correct, and Malthus is a boogeyman rather than economist,
exactly.
And you can probably say that may be true for most economists. How many are boogeymen, and how many are actually reasonable and rational?
But just to clarify what you're saying there, I think that that fit everyone in the state of Texas ideas is thrown around so much that it probably isn't true. I would be surprised if the numbers actually work out. But I think the point is there. Our perception of the fact that the world is so crowded is largely influenced by the fact that the majority of the world's population lives in urban centers at this point, or urban areas at this point in time. For the first time in human history, the majority of the world's population now lives in cities. And that obviously influences our perception of how much space actually exists. And people who go out into the countryside may just take a moment to reflect on the vast amounts of uninhabited land that exist right now. And I understand that large sections of that are not habitable, but still, the point, I think, is there that there's a lot of room to grow. But I think there's another point to this as well, which is that, yes, the population is increasing right now and is expected to reach 9 billion by 2050, at which point it will start declining because of a phenomenon known as demographic winter. Basically, the birth rate is falling in every major industrialized nation below the replacement level of 2.1 children per family. And this is really starting to take effect in countries like Japan, where I am, where, in fact, it is now literally a dying country. There are more deaths than births here each year. And we have another phenomenon that isn't reported on very much, but it is really shocking. In the last 50 years, the sperm levels of Western men has declined 50%, and 85% of the remaining sperm are abnormal. They are actually rejiggering the numbers that they use to calculate whether or not someone is infertile. They're having to lower that every decade or so because the numbers keep
it's
lowering.
It's kind of like unemployment rate, and they
have to readjust
the mathematics to get the result they're looking for.
Exactly right. I mean, it is a staggering phenomenon and obviously related to all of the chemical garbage that's being put into our environment in so many different ways. But that issue is not looked at all. It's hardly ever talked about. There was a really, really interesting documentary that appeared on the CBC in Canada a few years ago called The Disappearing Male. I think it's still available online. I would suggest people check it out. It's a very worrying phenomenon, and I think related to that depopulation agenda that we know that people like Ted Turner and Prince Philip and others are advocating.
You know, I visited India years ago. I actually worked my way over there. I was like 19 years old, and I got a job on a tramp steamer and worked my way from Houston, Texas, through the Mediterranean and up to Calcutta and Madras, hauling grain over there. And one of the things that I realized, India was overpopulated then. Today it's even worse. All right? They had a high population, at least in parts. But the reason they could afford that much population is because it was an extraordinarily benign climate. You could sleep out on the street and it wasn't a problem. You didn't really need a house. It was possible, and what it made me realize is that the only place you're really going to see overpopulation is in a very benign climate where you can perhaps pick fruit right off the tree. Not a problem. Just walk down the street. The fruit is there if you care to help yourself to it. And as a result, you might not need a house. On the other hand, if you get into a completely harsh climate, say the Arabian Desert.
Northern Canada?
Well, yeah. Same thing.
I'm from Canada.
The overpopulation takes place in, you know, benign climates, which is interesting, at least to me. I'm not sure if that's interesting to anyone else, but it was interesting to me. Other point is, you were talking about Japan's problem, the demographic. I saw a report that they sell more adult diapers in Japan right now than they sell diapers for children.
Which unfortunately, that is true. Yeah.
Yeah. Just that's an astonishing, you know. So, oh my God, how can that be? How possibly be? How do the people in Japan? We're going to run out of time here. We've got, what have we got? A minute and a half, something like that. Minute, 2 minutes maybe left. How do the people of Japan respond to this? Do they have a sense of foreboding? You know, they're anticipating a grim future. Are they maintaining a stiff upper lip if they do that in Japan? How are they responding to this kind of information?
I don't think many people are optimistic about the way this society is heading right now. There may be people who hide their pessimism better than others, but I think that the overall idea is that, yes, this is a country in crisis in a lot of ways. And I don't think it's openly discussed in those terms as much as you would think it would be. But it is certainly something that's dawning on a lot of people, especially now that, of course, all these pensioners are retiring and starting to cash in on their bonds rather than buy the bonds. This creates an economic problem for the government in trying to service its debt. It creates an economic burden on all of the young workers who are now supporting more and more pensioners. It's a system that is falling apart and is going to really start falling apart in the coming years as this demographic winter accelerates. So, unfortunately, I don't think anyone sees a ray of sunshine coming through in Japan right now.
How long before we face a real crisis? We can see that something's coming. How long before we get to that crisis day?
Well, that's a broad question, but I mean, if the trends continue, you could say we're already on the brink of it. We're already stepping into it. It's just a question of when we start realizing that this is a crisis. And I think that as long as the Malthusian propaganda that we're still heading towards this overpopulation crisis, as long as that is still the dominant narrative, then we haven't realized what the nature of this crisis is.
Okay, James, thanks very much for being on the program. As always, James Corbett from the Corbett Report, Corbett, report.com. I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, James, and Frank, the producer. Good night.
I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? But still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's too bad.